Chapter 5. It was nearer 7 than 6:30 when I approached the vicarage gate on my return. Before I reached it, it swung open and Lawrence Redding came out. He stopped dead on seeing me, and I was immediately struck by his appearance. He looked like a man who was on the point of going mad. His eyes stared in a peculiar manner. He was deathly white, and he was shaking and twitching all over. I wondered for a moment whether he could have been drinking, but repudiated the idea immediately. "Hello," I said. "Have you been to see me again? Sorry I was out. Come back now. I've got to see Protheroe about some accounts, but I dare say we shan't be long."
"Protheroe," he said.
He began to laugh.
"Protheroe! You're going to see Protheroe? Oh, you'll see Protheroe all right. Oh, my God! Yes!"
I stared. Instinctively, I stretched out a hand towards him. He drew sharply aside.
"No!" he almost cried out. "I got to get away! To think! I got to think! I must think!"
He broke into a run and vanished rapidly down the road towards the village, leaving me staring after him, my first idea of drunkenness recurring. Finally, I shook my head and went on to the vicarage. The front door is always left open, but nevertheless I rang the bell. Mary came wiping her hands on her apron.
"So, you're back at last," she observed.
"Is Colonel Protheroe here?" I asked.
"In the study. Been here since 6:15.
"And Mr. Redding's been here?"
"Come a few minutes ago. Asked for you. I told him you'd be back at any minute, and that Colonel Protheroe was waiting in the study, and he said he'd wait too, and went there. He's there now."
"No, he isn't," I said. "I've just met him going down the road."
"Well, I didn't hear him leave. He can't have stayed more than 2 minutes. The mistress isn't back from town yet."
I nodded absent-mindedly. Mary beat a retreat to the kitchen quarters, and I went down the passage and opened the study door. After the dusk of the passage, the evening sunshine that was pouring into the room made my eyes blink. I took a step or two across the floor and then stopped dead. For a moment, I could hardly take in the meaning of the scene before me. Colonel Protheroe was lying sprawled across my writing table in a horrible, unnatural position. There was a pool of some dark fluid on the desk by his head, and it was slowly dripping onto the floor with a horrible drip, drip, drip. I pulled myself together and went across to him. His skin was cold to the touch. The hand that I raised fell back lifeless. The man was dead, shot through the head. I went to the door and called Mary. When she came, I ordered her to run as fast as she could and fetch Dr. Haydock, who lives just at the corner of the road. I told her there had been an accident. Then I went back and closed the door to await the doctor's coming. Fortunately, Mary found him at home. Haydock is a good fellow, a big, fine, strapping man with an honest, rugged face. His eyebrows went up when I pointed silently across the room, but, like a true doctor, he showed no signs of emotion. He bent over the dead man, examining him rapidly. Then he straightened himself and looked across at me.
"Well?"
I asked.
"He's dead right enough. Been dead 30 minutes, I should say."
"Suicide?"
"Out of the question, man. Look at the position of the wound. Besides, if he shot himself, where's the weapon?"
True enough, there was no sign of any such thing.
"We'd better not mess around with anything," said Haydock. "I'd better ring up the police."
He picked up the receiver and spoke into it. He gave the facts as curtly as possible and then replaced the telephone and came across to where I was sitting.
"This is a rotten business. How did you come to find him?"
I explained. Is it murder?" I asked rather faintly.
"Looks like it. Mean to say, What else can it be? Extraordinary business. Wonder who had a down on the poor old fellow. Of course, I know he wasn't popular, but one isn't often murdered for that reason. Worse luck.
There's one rather curious thing, I said. I was telephoned for this afternoon to go to a dying parishioner. When I got there, everyone was very surprised to see me. The sick man was very much better than he had been for some days, and his wife flatly denied telephoning for me at all. Haydock drew his brows together.
That's suggestive. Very. You were being got out of the way. Where's your wife?
Gone up to London for the day.
And the maid?
In the kitchen? Right at the other side of the house.
Where she wouldn't be likely to hear anything that went on in here. It's a nasty business. Who knew that Prothero was coming here this evening?
He referred to the fact this morning in the village street at the top of his voice, as usual.
Meaning that the whole village knew it? Which they always do in any case. Know of anyone who had a grudge against him?
The thought of Lawrence Redding's white face and staring eyes came to my mind. I was spared answering by a noise of shuffling feet in the passage outside.
The police,
said my friend, and rose to his feet. Our police force was represented by Constable Hurst, looking very important but slightly worried.
Good evening, gentlemen, he greeted us. The inspector will be here any minute. In the meantime, I'll follow out his instructions. I understand Colonel Prothero's been found shot in the vicarage.
He paused and directed a look of cold suspicion at me, which I tried to meet with a suitable bearing of conscious innocence. He moved over to the writing table and announced,
"Nothing to be touched until the inspector comes."
He got out his notebook, moistened his pencil, and looked expectantly at both of us. I repeated my story of discovering the body. When he had got it all down, which took some time, he turned to the doctor.
In your opinion, Dr. Haydock, what was the cause of death? Shot through the head at close quarters.
And the weapon?
I can't say with certainty until we get the bullet out, but I should say in all probability the bullet was fired from a pistol of small caliber, say a Mauser .25.
I started, remembering our conversation of the night before and Lawrence Redding's admission. The police constable brought his cold, fish-like eye round on me.
Did you speak, sir?
I shook my head. Whatever suspicions I might have, they were no more than suspicions, and as such, to be kept to myself.
When, in your opinion, did the tragedy occur?
The doctor hesitated for a minute before he answered. Then he said,
The man has been dead just over half an hour, I should say. Certainly not longer.
Hurst turned to me.
Did the girl hear anything?
As far as I know, she heard nothing, I said. But you had better ask her. But at this moment, Inspector Slack arrived, having come by car from Much Benham, 2 miles away. All that I can say of Inspector Slack is that never did a man more determinedly strive to contradict his name. He was a dark man, restless and energetic in manner, with black eyes that snapped ceaselessly. His manner was rude and overbearing in the extreme. He acknowledged our greetings with a curt nod, seized his subordinate's notebook, perused it, exchanged a few curt words with him in an undertone, then strode over to the body.
Everything's been messed up and pulled about, I suppose, he said. I've touched nothing, said Haydock.
No more have I said. The inspector busied himself for some time, peering at the things on the table and examining the pool of blood.
Ah, he said, in a tone of triumph. Here's what we want. Clock overturned when he fell forward. That'll give us the time of the crime. 6:22. What time did you say death occurred, Doctor?
I said about half an hour, but...
The inspector consulted his watch.
7:05. I got word about 10 minutes ago, at 7:05. Discovery of the body was at about 7:15. I understand you were fetched immediately. Say you examined it at 10 minutes too? Why, that brings it to the identical second almost.
I don't guarantee the time absolutely, said Haydock. That is an approximate estimate.
Good enough, sir, good enough.
I had been trying to get a word in.
About the clock, if you'll excuse me, sir, I'll ask you any questions I want to know. Time's short. What I want is absolute silence.
Yes, but I'd like to tell you...
Absolute silence, said the inspector, glaring at me ferociously.
I gave him what he asked for. He was still peering about the writing table.
What was he sitting here for?
He grunted.
Did he want to write a note? Hello? What's this?
He held up a piece of notepaper triumphantly. So pleased was he with his find that he permitted us to come to his side and examine it with him. It was a piece of vicarage notepaper, and it was headed at the top, 6:20. Dear Clement, it began. Sorry I cannot wait any longer, but I must... Here, the writing tailed off in a scrawl.
Plain as a pikestaff, said Inspector Slack triumphantly. He sits down here to write this. An enemy comes softly in through the window and shoots him as he writes. What more do you want?
I'd just like to say, I began.
Out of the way, if you please, sir. I want to see if there are footprints.
He went down on his hands and knees, moving towards the open window. I think you ought to know, I said obstinately. The inspector rose. He spoke without heat, but firmly.
We'll go into all that later. I'd be obliged if you gentlemen will clear out of here. Right out, if you please.
We permitted ourselves to be shooed out like children. Hours seemed to have passed, yet it was only 7:15.
Well, said Haydock, that's that. When that conceited ass wants me... You can send him over to the surgery. So long.
The mistress is back, said Mary,
making a brief appearance from the kitchen. Her eyes were round and agog with excitement.
Come in about 5 minutes ago.
I found Griselda in the drawing room. She looked frightened but excited. I told her everything and she listened attentively. The letter is headed 6:20, I ended. And the clock fell over and has stopped at 6:22. Yes, said Griselda, but that clock, didn't you tell him that it was always kept 1/4 hour fast? No, I said, I didn't. He wouldn't let me. I tried my best. Griselda was frowning in a puzzled manner. But Len, she said, that makes the whole thing perfectly extraordinary. Because when that clock said 6:20, it was really only 5 minutes past, and at 5 minutes past, I don't suppose Colonel Protheroe had even arrived at the house. Chapter 6. We puzzled over the business of the clock for some time, but we could make nothing of it. Griselda said I ought to make another effort to tell Inspector Slack about it. But on that point, I was feeling what I can only describe as mulish. Inspector Slack had been abominably and most unnecessarily rude. I was looking forward to a moment when I could produce my valuable contribution and effect his discomfiture. I would then say in a tone of mild reproach, "If you had only listened to me, Inspector Slack." I expected that he would at least speak to me before he left the house, but to our surprise, we learned from Mary that he had departed, having locked up the study door and issued orders that no one was to attempt to enter the room. Griselda suggested going up to Old Hall. "It will be so awful for Anne Protheroe, with the police and everything," she said. "Perhaps I might be able to do something for her." I cordially approved of this plan, and Griselda set off with instructions that she was to telephone to me if she thought that I could be of any use or comfort to either of the ladies. I now proceeded to ring up the Sunday school teachers, who were coming at 7:45 for their weekly preparation class. I thought that under the circumstances, it would be better to put them off. Dennis was the next person to arrive on the scene, having just returned from a tennis party. The fact that murder had taken place at the vicarage seemed to afford him acute satisfaction.
"Fancy being right on the spot in a murder case!" he exclaimed. "I've always wanted to be right in the midst of one. Why have the police locked up the study? Wouldn't one of the other door keys fit it?"
I refused to allow anything of the sort to be attempted. Dennis gave in with a bad grace. After extracting every possible detail from me, he went out into the garden to look for footprints, remarking cheerfully that he was lucky it was only old Protheroe whom everyone disliked. His cheerful callousness rather grated on me, but I reflected that I was perhaps being hard on the boy. At Dennis's age, a detective story is one of the best things in life, and to find a real detective story, complete with corpse, waiting on one's own front doorstep, so to speak, is bound to send a healthy-minded boy into the seventh heaven of enjoyment. Death means very little to a boy of 16. Griselda came back in about an hour's time. She had seen Anne Protheroe, having arrived just after the inspector had broken the news to her. On hearing that Mrs. Protheroe had last seen her husband in the village about a quarter to six, and that she had no light of any kind to throw upon the matter, he had taken his departure, explaining that he would return on the morrow for a fuller interview. "He was quite decent in his way," said Griselda grudgingly. "How did Mrs. Protheroe take it?" I asked.
"Well, she was very quiet, but then she always is."
"Yes," I said. "I can't imagine Anne Protheroe going into hysterics."
"Of course it was a great shock, you could see that. She thanked me for coming and said she was very grateful, but that there was nothing I could do."
"What about Lettice?"
"She was out playing tennis somewhere. She hadn't got home yet."
There was a pause, and then Griselda said,
"You know, Len, she was really very quiet. Very queer indeed."
"The shock," I suggested.
"Yes, I suppose so, and yet..."
Griselda furrowed her brows perplexedly.
"It wasn't like that somehow. She didn't seem so much bowled over as, well, terrified."
"Terrified?"
"Yes. Not showing it, you know. At least, not meaning to show it. But a queer, watchful look in her eyes. I wonder if she has a sort of idea who did kill him. She asked again and again if anyone were suspected."
"Did she?" I said thoughtfully.
"Yes. Of course Anne's got marvellous self-control, but one could see that she was terribly upset. More so than I would have thought, for after all, it wasn't as though she was so devoted to him. I should have said she rather disliked him, if anything."
"Death alters one's feelings sometimes," I said.
"Yes, I suppose so."
Dennis came in and was full of excitement over a footprint he had found in one of the flower beds. He was sure that the police had overlooked it and that it would turn out to be the turning point of the mystery. I spent a troubled night. Dennis was up and about and out of the house long before breakfast to study the latest developments, as he said. Nevertheless, it was not he but Mary who brought us the morning's sensational bit of news. We had just sat down to breakfast when she burst into the room, her cheeks red and her eyes shining, and addressed us with her customary lack of ceremony.
"Would you believe it? The baker's just told me. They've arrested young Mr. Redding."
"Arrested Lawrence?" cried Griselda incredulously. "Impossible. It must be some stupid mistake."
"No mistake about it, ma'am," said Mary,
with a kind of gloating exultation.
"Mr. Redding, he went there himself and gave himself up. Last night, last thing. Went right in, threw down the pistol on the table, and 'I did it,' he says. Just like that."
She looked at us both, nodded her head vigorously, and withdrew satisfied with the effect she had produced. Griselda and I stared at each other.
"Oh, it isn't true," said Griselda. "It can't be true."
She noticed my silence and said, "Len, you don't think it's true?" I found it hard to answer her. I sat silent, thoughts whirling through my head.
"He must be mad," said Griselda. "Absolutely mad. Or do you think they were looking at the pistol together and it suddenly went off?"
"That doesn't sound at all a likely thing to happen."
"But it must have been an accident of some kind, because there's not a shadow of a motive. What earthly reason could Lawrence have for killing Colonel Protheroe?"
I could have answered that question very decidedly, but I wished to spare Anne Protheroe as far as possible. There might still be a chance of keeping her name out of it. "Remember they had had a quarrel," I said.
"About Lettice and her bathing dress?"
"Yes, but that's absurd. And even if he and Lettice were engaged secretly, well, that's not a reason for killing her father." "We don't know what the true facts of the case may be, Griselda."
"You do believe it, Len? Oh, how can you? I tell you, I'm sure Lawrence never touched a hair of his head."
"Remember, I met him just outside the gate. He looked like a madman."
"Yes, but, oh, it's impossible."
"There's the clock, too," I said. "This explains the clock. Lawrence must have put it back to 6:20 with the idea of making an alibi for himself. Look how Inspector Slack fell into the trap."
"You're wrong, Len. Lawrence knew about that clock being fast. Keeping the vicar up to time, he used to say. Lawrence would never have made the mistake of putting it back to 6:22. He'd have put the hands somewhere possible, like 6:45.
He mayn't have known what time Protheroe got here, or he may have simply forgotten about the clock being fast." Griselda disagreed.
"No, if you were committing a murder, you'd be awfully careful about things like that."
"You don't know, my dear," I said mildly. "You've never done one." Before Griselda could reply, a shadow fell across the breakfast table, and a very gentle voice said,
"I hope I'm not intruding. You must forgive me, but in the sad circumstances, the very sad circumstances..."
It was our neighbour, Miss Marple. Accepting our polite disclaimers, she stepped in through the window, and I drew up a chair for her. She looked faintly flushed and quite excited.
"Very terrible, is it not? Poor Colonel Protheroe, not a very pleasant man, perhaps, and not exactly popular, but it's none the less sad for that. And actually shot in the vicarage study, I understand."
I said that that had indeed been the case.
"But the dear vicar was not here at the time?" Miss Marple questioned of Griselda.
I explained where I had been.
"Mr. Dennis is not with you this morning," said Miss Marple, glancing round.
"Dennis," said Griselda, "fancies himself as an amateur detective. He is very excited about a footprint he found in one of the flower beds, and I fancy has gone off to tell the police about it."
"Dear, dear," said Miss Marple. "Such a to-do, is it not? And Mr. Dennis thinks he knows who committed the crime. Well, I suppose we all think we know."
"You mean it is obvious?" said Griselda.
"No, dear, I don't mean that at all. I dare say everyone thinks it is somebody different. That is why it is so important to have proofs. I, for instance, am quite convinced I know who did it. But I must admit, I haven't one shadow of proof. One must, I know, be very careful of what one says at a time like this. Criminal libel, don't they call it? I had made up my mind to be most careful with Inspector Slack. He sent word he would come and see me this morning, but now he has just phoned up to say it won't be necessary after all."
"I suppose, since the arrest, it isn't necessary," I said.
"The arrest?"
Miss Marple leaned forward, her cheeks pink with excitement.
"I didn't know there had been an arrest."
It is so seldom that Miss Marple is worse informed than we are that I had taken it for granted that she would know the latest developments. "It seems we have been talking at cross purposes," I said. "Yes, there has been an arrest. Lawrence Redding."
Lawrence Redding? Miss Marple seemed very surprised. Now I should not have thought.
Griselda interrupted vehemently.
I can't believe it even now. No, not though he has actually confessed.
Confessed? Said Miss Marple. You say he has confessed. Oh dear, I see I have been sadly at sea. Yes, sadly at sea.
I can't help feeling it must have been some kind of an accident, said Griselda.
Don't you think so, Len? I mean, his coming forward to give himself up looks like that.
Miss Marple leant forward eagerly.
He gave himself up, you say?
Yes.
Oh, said Miss Marple with a deep sigh. I am so glad, so very glad.
I looked at her in some surprise. It shows a true state of remorse, I suppose, I said.
Remorse?
Miss Marple looked very surprised.
Oh, but surely, dear, dear vicar, you don't think that he is guilty?
It was my turn to stare. But since he has confessed...
Yes, but that just proves it, doesn't it? I mean, that he had nothing to do with it.
No, I said. I may be dense, but I can't see that it does. If you have not committed a murder, I cannot see the object of pretending you have.
Of course there's reason, said Miss Marple. Naturally, there's always a reason, isn't there? And young men are so hot-headed and often prone to believe the worst.
She turned to Griselda.
Don't you agree with me, my dear?
I don't know, said Griselda. It's difficult to know what to think. I can't see any reason for Lawrence behaving like a perfect idiot.
If you had seen his face last night, I began.
Tell me, said Miss Marple.
I described my homecoming while she listened attentively. When I had finished, she said,
I know that I am very often rather foolish and don't take in things as I should, but I really do not see your point. It seems to me that if a young man had made up his mind to the great wickedness of taking a fellow creature's life, he would not appear distraught about it afterwards. It would be a premeditated and cold-blooded action, and though the murderer might be a little flurried and possibly might make some small mistake, I do not think it likely he would fall into a state of agitation such as you describe. It is difficult to put oneself in such a position, but I cannot imagine getting into a state like that myself.
We don't know the circumstances, I argued. If there was a quarrel, the shot may have been fired in a sudden gust of passion, and Lawrence might afterwards have been appalled at what he had done. Indeed, I prefer to think that this is what did actually occur.
I know, dear Mr. Clement, that there are many ways we prefer to look at things, but one must actually take facts as they are, must one not? And it does not seem to me that the facts bear the interpretation you put upon them. Your maid distinctly stated that Mr. Redding was only in the house a couple of minutes, not long enough, surely, for a quarrel such as you describe. And then again, I understand, the colonel was shot through the back of the head while he was writing a letter. At least, that is what my maid told me.
Quite true, said Griselda. He seems to have been writing a note to say he couldn't wait any longer. The note was dated 6:20, and the clock on the table was overturned and had stopped at 6:22, and that's just what has been puzzling Len and myself so frightfully.
She explained our custom of keeping the clock a quarter of an hour fast.
Very curious, said Miss Marple. Very curious indeed. But the note seems to me even more curious still. I mean...
She stopped and looked round. Lettice Prothero was standing outside the window. She came in, nodding to us and murmuring,
Morning.
She dropped into a chair and said, with rather more animation than usual,
They've arrested Lawrence, I hear.
Yes, said Griselda. It's been a great shock to us.
I never really thought anyone would murder Father, said Lettice.
She was obviously taking a pride in letting no hint of distress or emotion escape her.
Lots of people wanted to, I'm sure. There are times when I'd have liked to do it myself.
Won't you have something to eat or drink, Lettice? Asked Griselda.
No, thank you. I just drifted round to see if you'd got my beret here. A queer little yellow one. I think I left it in the study the other day.
If you did, it's there still, said Griselda. Mary never tidies anything.
I'll go and see, said Lettice, rising. Sorry to be such a bother, but I seem to have lost everything else in the hat line.
I'm afraid you can't get it now, I said. Inspector Slack has locked the room up.
Oh, what a bore. Can't we get in through the window?
I'm afraid not. It is latched on the inside.
Surely, Lettice, a yellow beret won't be much good to you at present.
You mean mourning and all that? I shan't bother about mourning. I think it's an awfully archaic idea. It's a nuisance about Lawrence. Yes, it's a nuisance.
She got up and stood frowning abstractedly.
I suppose it's all on account of me and my bathing dress. So silly. The whole thing.
Griselda opened her mouth to say something, but for some unexplained reason shut it again.
A curious smile came to Lettice's lips.
I think, she said softly, I'll go home and tell Anne about Lawrence being arrested.
She went out of the window again. Griselda turned to Miss Marple.
Why did you step on my foot?
The old lady was smiling.
I thought you were going to say something, my dear, and it is often so much better to let things develop on their own lines. I don't think, you know, that child is half so vague as she pretends to be. She's got a very definite idea in her head, and she's acting upon it.
Mary gave a loud knock on the dining room door and entered hard upon it.
What is it? Said Griselda. And Mary, you must remember not to knock on doors. I've told you about it before.
Thought you might be busy, said Mary. Colonel Melchett's here. Wants to see the master.
Colonel Melchett is chief constable of the county. I rose at once.
I thought you wouldn't like my leaving him in the hall, so I put him in the drawing room, went on Mary. Shall I clear?
Not yet, said Griselda. I'll ring. She turned to Miss Marple, and I left the room. Chapter 7 Colonel Melchett is a dapper little man with a habit of snorting suddenly and unexpected. He has red hair and rather keen, bright blue eyes.
Good morning, Vicar, he said. Nasty business, eh? Poor old Prothero. Not that I liked him. I didn't. Nobody did, for that matter. Nasty bit of work for you, too. Hope it hasn't upset your missus.
I said Griselda had taken it very well.
That's lucky. Rotten thing to happen in one's house. I must say I'm surprised at young Redding, doing it the way he did. No sort of consideration for anyone's feelings.
A wild desire to laugh came over me, but Colonel Melchett evidently saw nothing odd in the idea of a murderer being considerate, so I held my peace.
I must say, I was rather taken aback when I heard the fellow had marched in and given himself up,
continued Colonel Melchett, dropping onto a chair. How did it happen exactly?
Last night, about 10 o'clock, fellow rolls in, throws down a pistol and says, here I am, I did it, just like that.
What account does he give of the business?
Precious little. He was warned, of course, about making a statement. But he merely laughed. Said he came here to see you. Found Prothero here. They had words, and he shot him. Won't say what the quarrel was about.
Look here, Clement, just between you and me. Do you know anything about it? I've heard rumours about his being forbidden the house and all that. What was it? Did he seduce the daughter, or what? We don't want to bring the girl into it more than we can help for everybody's sake. Was that the trouble?
No, I said. You can take it from me that it was something quite different, but I can't say more at the present juncture. He nodded and rose.
I'm glad to know. There's a lot of talk.
too many women in this part of the world. Well, I must get along. I've got to see Haydock.
He was called out to some case or other, but he ought to be back by now.
I don't mind telling you, I'm sorry about Redding.
He always struck me as a decent young chap. Perhaps they'll think out some kind of defence for him. After effects of war, shell shock or something. Especially if no very adequate motive turns up.
I must be off. Like to come along?
I said I would like to very much, and we went out together. Haydock's house is next door to mine. His servant said the doctor had just come in and showed us into the dining room, where Haydock was sitting down to a steaming plate of eggs and bacon. He greeted me with an amiable nod.
Sorry I had to go out. Confinement case. I've been up most of the night over your business. I've got the bullet for you.
He shoved a little box along the table. Melchett examined it.
0.25. Haydock nodded.
I'll keep the technical details for the inquest, he said. All you want to know is that death was practically instantaneous. Silly young fool. What did he want to do it for? Amazing, by the way, that nobody heard the shot.
Yes, said Melchett. That surprises me.
The kitchen window gives on the other side of the house, I said. With the study door, the pantry door and the kitchen door all shut, I doubt if you would hear anything, and there was no one but the maid in the house.
Hmm, said Melchett. It's odd, all the same. I wonder the old lady, what's her name? Marple didn't hear it. The study window was open.
Perhaps she did, said Haydock.
I don't think she did, said I. She was over at the vicarage just now, and she didn't mention anything of the kind, which I'm certain she would have done if there had been anything to tell.
May have heard it and paid no attention to it, thought it was a car backfiring.
It struck me that Haydock was looking much more jovial and good-humoured this morning. He seemed like a man who was decorously trying to subdue unusually good spirits.
Or what about a silencer? He added. That's quite likely. Nobody would hear anything then.
Melchett shook his head.
Slack didn't find anything of the kind, and he asked Redding, and Redding didn't seem to know what he was talking about at first, and then denied point-blank using anything of the kind. And I suppose one can take his word for it.
Yes, indeed, poor devil. Damned young fool, said Colonel Melchett.
Sorry, Clement, but he really is. Somehow I can't get used to thinking of him as a murderer.
Any motive? Asked Haydock, taking a final draught of coffee and pushing back his chair.
He says they quarrelled and he lost his temper and shot him.
Hoping for manslaughter, eh? The doctor shook his head. That story doesn't hold water. He stole up behind him as he was writing and shot him through the head. Precious little quarrel about that.
Anyway, there wouldn't have been time for a quarrel, I said, remembering Miss Marple's words. To creep up, shoot him, alter the clock hands back to 6:20 and leave again would have taken him all his time. I shall never forget his face when I met him outside the gate, or the way he said, "You want to see Protheroe? Oh, you'll see him, all right." That in itself ought to have made me suspicious of what had just taken place a few minutes before.
Haydock stared at me.
What do you mean, what had just taken place? When do you think Redding shot him?
A few minutes before I got to the house.
The doctor shook his head.
Impossible. Plumb impossible. He'd been dead much longer than that.
But my dear man, cried Colonel Melchett, you said yourself that half an hour was only an approximate estimate.
Half an hour? 35 minutes? 25 minutes? 20 minutes? Possibly. But less? No.
Why? The body would have been warm when I got to it. We stared at each other. Haydock's face had changed. It had gone suddenly grey and old. I wondered at the change in him.
But look here, Haydock,
the Colonel found his voice.
If Redding admits shooting him at 7:15,
Haydock sprang to his feet.
I tell you it's impossible, he roared. If Redding says he killed Prothero at 7:15, then Redding lies. Hang it all, I tell you, I'm a doctor, and I know. The blood had begun to congeal.
If Redding is lying, began Melchett. He stopped, shook his head.
We'd better go down to the police station and see him, he said.
Chapter 8. We were rather silent on our way down to the police station. Haydock drew behind a little and murmured to me,
You know, I don't like the look of this. I don't like it. There's something here we don't understand.
He looked thoroughly worried and upset. Inspector Slack was at the police station, and presently we found ourselves face to face with Lawrence Redding. He looked pale and strained, but quite composed. Marvellously so, I thought, considering the circumstances. Melchett snorted and hummed, obviously nervous.
Look here, Redding, he said. I understand you made a statement to Inspector Slack here. You state you went to the vicarage at approximately 7:15, found Prothero there, quarrelled with him, shot him, and came away. I'm not reading it over to you, but that's the gist of it.
Yes.
I'm going to ask a few questions. You've already been told that you needn't answer them, unless you choose. Your solicitor...
Lawrence interrupted.
I've nothing to hide. I killed Prothero.
Ah, well... Melchett snorted. How did you happen to have a pistol with you?
Lawrence hesitated.
It was in my pocket.
You took it with you to the vicarage?
Yes.
Why?
I always take it.
He had hesitated again before answering, and I was absolutely sure that he was not speaking the truth.
Why did you put the clock back?
The clock? He seemed puzzled.
Yes. The hands pointed to 6:22.
A look of fear sprang up in his face.
Oh, that, yes. I altered it.
Haydock spoke suddenly.
Where did you shoot Colonel Prothero?
In the study at the vicarage.
I mean, in what part of the body?
Oh, I... Through the head, I think. Yes, through the head.
Aren't you sure?
Since you know, I can't see why it is necessary to ask me.
It was a feeble kind of bluster. There was some commotion outside. A constable without a helmet brought in a note.
For the vicar. It says very urgent on it.
I tore it open and read.
Please, please, come to me. I don't know what to do. It is all too awful. I want to tell someone. Please come immediately and bring anyone you like with you. Anne Prothero.
I gave Melchett a meaning glance. He took the hint. We all went out together. Glancing over my shoulder, I had a glimpse of Lawrence Redding's face. His eyes were riveted on the paper in my hand, and I have hardly ever seen such a terrible look of anguish and despair in any human being's face. I remembered Anne Prothero sitting on my sofa and saying, I'm a desperate woman, and my heart grew heavy within me. I saw now the possible reason for Lawrence Redding's heroic self-accusation. Melchett was speaking to Slack.
Have you got any line on Redding's movements early in the day? There's some reason to think he shot Prothero earlier than he says. Get on to it, will you?
He turned to me, and without a word I handed him Anne Prothero's letter. He read it and pursed up his lips in astonishment. Then he looked at me inquiringly.
Is this what you were hinting at this morning?
Yes. I was not sure then if it was my duty to speak. I am quite sure now. And I told him of what I had seen that night in the studio. The colonel had a few words with the inspector, and then we set off for Old Hall. Dr. Haydock came with us. A very correct butler opened the door with just the right amount of gloom in his bearing.
Good morning, said Melchett. Will you ask Mrs. Prothero's maid to tell her we are here
and would like to see her, and then return here and answer a few questions."
The butler hurried away and presently returned with the news that he had dispatched the message.
"Now, let's hear something about yesterday," said Colonel Melchett. "Your master was in to lunch."
"Yes, sir."
"And in his usual spirits?"
"As far as I could see, yes, sir."
"What happened after that?"
"After luncheon, Mrs. Prothero went to lie down, and the Colonel went to his study. Miss Lettice went out to a tennis party in the two-seater. Colonel and Mrs. Prothero had tea at 4:30 in the drawing-room. The car was ordered for 5:30 to take them to the village. Immediately after they had left, Mr. Clement rang up. He bowed to me. I told him they had started."
"Hmph," said Colonel Melchett. "When was Mr. Redding last here?"
"On Tuesday afternoon, sir."
"I understand that there was a disagreement between them."
"I believe so, sir. The Colonel gave me orders that Mr. Redding was not to be admitted in future."
"Did you overhear the quarrel at all?"
asked Colonel Melchett bluntly. "Colonel Prothero, sir, had a very loud voice, especially when it was raised in anger. I was unable to help overhearing a few words here and there."
"Enough to tell you the cause of the dispute."
"I understood, sir, that it had to do with a portrait Mr. Redding had been painting, a portrait of Miss Lettice."
Melchett grunted.
"Did you see Mr. Redding when he left?"
"Yes, sir. I let him out."
"Did he seem angry?"
"No, sir, if I may say so. He seemed rather amused."
"Ah, he didn't come to the house yesterday?"
"No, sir."
"Anyone else come?"
"Not yesterday, sir."
"Well, the day before?"
"Mr. Dennis Clement came in the afternoon, and Dr. Stone was here for some time. And there was a lady in the evening."
"A lady?"
Melchett was surprised.
"Who was she?"
The butler couldn't remember her name. It was a lady he had not seen before. Yes, she had given her name, and when he told her that the family were at dinner, she had said that she would wait. So he had shown her into the little morning room. She had asked for Colonel Prothero, not Mrs. Prothero. He had told the Colonel, and the Colonel had gone to the morning room directly dinner was over. How long had the lady stayed? He thought about half an hour. The Colonel himself had let her out.
Ah, yes, he remembered her name now.
The lady had been a Mrs. Lestrange. This was a surprise.
"Curious," said Melchett. "Really, very curious."
But we pursued the matter no further, for at that moment a message came that Mrs. Prothero would see us. Anne was in bed. Her face was pale and her eyes very bright. There was a look on her face that puzzled me, a kind of grim determination. She spoke to me. "Thank you for coming so promptly," she said. "I see you've understood what I meant by bringing anyone you liked with you." She paused. "It's best to get it over quickly, isn't it?" she said. She gave a queer, half-pathetic little smile. "I suppose you're the person I ought to say it to, Colonel Melchett. You see, it was I who killed my husband." Colonel Melchett said gently,
"My dear Mrs. Prothero."
"Oh, it's quite true. I suppose I've said it rather bluntly, but I never can go into hysterics over anything. I've hated him for a long time, and yesterday I shot him." She lay back on the pillows and closed her eyes. "That's all. I suppose you'll arrest me and take me away. I'll get up and dress as soon as I can. At the moment, I am feeling rather sick."
"Are you aware, Mrs. Prothero, that Mr. Lawrence Redding has already accused himself of committing the crime?"
Anne opened her eyes and nodded brightly. "I know, silly boy. He's very much in love with me, you know. It was frightfully noble of him, but very silly.
He knew that it was you who had committed the crime."
"Yes."
"How did he know?"
She hesitated.
Did you tell him?
Still she hesitated. Then at last she seemed to make up her mind. Yes, I told him. She twitched her shoulders with a movement of irritation.
Can't you go away now? I've told you. I don't want to talk about it any more. Where did you get the pistol, Mrs. Protheroe?
A pistol? Oh, it was my husband's. I got it out of the drawer of his dressing table.
I see. And you took it with you to the vicarage?
Yes. I knew he would be there.
What time was this?
It must have been after 6. 6:15, something like that.
You took the pistol, meaning to shoot your husband?
No. I meant it for myself.
I see. But you went to the vicarage?
Yes. I went along to the window. There were no voices. I looked in. I saw my husband. Something came over me. And I fired.
And then?
Then? Oh, then I went away.
And told Mr. Redding what you had done.
Again, I noticed the hesitation in her voice before she said, yes.
Did anybody see you entering or leaving the vicarage?
No. At least, yes. Old Miss Marple. I talked to her for a few minutes. She was in her garden. She moved restlessly on the pillows. Isn't that enough? I've told you. Why do you want to go on bothering me?
Dr. Haydock moved to her side and felt her pulse. He beckoned to Melchett.
I'll stay with her, he said in a whisper, whilst you make the necessary arrangements. She oughtn't to be left. Might do herself a mischief.
Melchett nodded. We left the room and descended the stairs. I saw a thin, cadaverous-looking man come out of the adjoining room, and on impulse, I remounted the stairs.
Are you Colonel Protheroe's valet?
The man looked surprised.
Yes, sir.
Do you know whether your late master kept a pistol anywhere?
Not that I know of, sir.
Not in one of the drawers of his dressing table. Think, man.
The valet shook his head decisively.
I'm quite sure he didn't, sir. I'd have seen it if so. Bound to.
I hurried down the stairs after the others. Mrs. Protheroe had lied about the pistol.
Why?
Chapter 9. After leaving a message at the police station, Chief Constable announced his intention of paying a visit to Miss Marple.
You'd better come with me, Vicar, he said. I don't want to give a member of your flock hysterics, so lend the weight of your soothing presence.
I smiled. For all her fragile appearance, Miss Marple is capable of holding her own with any policeman or chief constable in existence.
What's she like?
Asked the Colonel as we rang the bell.
Anything she says to be depended upon, or otherwise?
I considered the matter.
I think she is quite dependable, I said cautiously.
That is, insofar as she is talking of what she has actually seen. Beyond that, of course, when you get on to what she thinks, well, that is another matter. She has a powerful imagination and systematically thinks the worst of everyone.
The typical elderly spinster, in fact, said Melchett with a laugh. Well, I ought to know the breed by now. Gad, the tea parties down here.
We were admitted by a very diminutive maid, and shown into a small drawing room.
A bit crowded, said Colonel Melchett, looking round, but plenty of good stuff. Ladies' room, eh, Clement?
I agreed, and at that moment the door opened, and Miss Marple made her appearance.
Very sorry to bother you, Miss Marple, said the Colonel, when I had introduced him,
putting on his bluff military manner, which he had an idea was attractive to elderly ladies.
Got to do my duty, you know.
Of course, said Miss Marple. I quite understand. Won't you sit down? And might I offer you a little glass of cherry brandy, my own making, a recipe of my grandmother's?
Thank you very much, Miss Marple. Very kind of you. But I think I won't. Nothing till lunchtime. That's my motto. Now, I want to talk to you about this sad business. Very sad business indeed. Upset us all, I'm sure. Well, it seems possible that owing to the position of your house and garden, you may have been able to tell us something we want to know about yesterday evening.
As a matter of fact, I was in my little garden from 5 o'clock onwards yesterday, and of course from there, well, one simply cannot help seeing anything that is going on next door.
I understand, Miss Marple, that Mrs. Protheroe passed this way yesterday evening.
Yes, she did. I called out to her, and she admired my roses.
Could you tell us about what time that was?
I should say it was just a minute or two after 6:15. Yes, that's right. The church clock had just chimed the quarter.
Very good. What happened next?
Well, Mrs. Protheroe said she was calling for her husband at the vicarage so that they could go home together. She had come along the lane, you understand, and she went into the vicarage by the back gate and across the garden.
She came from the lane?
Yes, I'll show you.
Full of eagerness, Miss Marple led us out into the garden and pointed out the lane that ran along by the bottom of the garden.
The path opposite, with the stile, leads to the hall, she explained. That was the way they were going home together. Mrs. Protheroe came from the village.
Perfectly, perfectly, said Colonel Melchett. And she went across to the vicarage, you say?
Yes, I saw her turn the corner of the house. I suppose the Colonel wasn't there yet, because she came back almost immediately and went down the lawn to the studio, that building there, the one the vicar lets Mr. Redding use as a studio.
I see. And, you didn't hear a shot, Miss Marple?
I didn't hear a shot then, said Miss Marple.
But you did hear one sometime.
Yes, I think there was a shot somewhere in the woods, but quite 5 or 10 minutes afterwards, and, as I say, out in the woods. At least I think so. It couldn't have been. Surely it couldn't have been.
She stopped, pale with excitement.
Yes, yes, we'll come to all that presently, said Colonel Melchett. Please, go on with your story. Mrs. Protheroe went down to the studio.
Yes, she went inside and waited. Presently Mr. Redding came along the lane from the village. He came to the vicarage gate, looked all round,
and saw you, Miss Marple.
As a matter of fact, he didn't see me, said Miss Marple, flushing slightly. Because, you see, just at that minute, I was bending right over, trying to get up one of those nasty dandelions, you know, so difficult. And then he went through the gate and down to the studio.
He didn't go near the house.
Oh, no. He went straight to the studio. Mrs. Protheroe came to the door to meet him. And then they both went inside.
Here Miss Marple contributed a singularly eloquent pause.
Perhaps she was sitting for him, I suggested. Perhaps, said Miss Marple.
And they came out when?
About 10 minutes later.
That was roughly.
The church clock had chimed the half hour. They strolled out through the garden gate and along the lane, and just at that minute, Dr. Stone came down the path leading to the hall and climbed over the stile and joined them. They all walked towards the village together. At the end of the lane, I think, but I can't be quite sure, they were joined by Miss Cram. I think it must have been Miss Cram because her skirts were so short.
You must have very good eyesight, Miss Marple, if you can observe as far as that.
I was observing a bird, said Miss Marple. A golden-crested wren, I think he was. A sweet little fellow. I had my glasses out, and that's how I happened to see Miss Cram, if it was Miss Cram, and I think so, join them.
Ah, well, that may be so, said Colonel Melchett. Now, since you seem very good at observing, did you happen to notice, Miss Marple, what sort of expression Mrs. Prothero and Mr. Redding had as they passed along the lane. "They were smiling and talking," said Miss Marple. "They seemed very happy to be together, if you know what I mean."
"They didn't seem upset or disturbed in any way."
"Oh, no, just the opposite."
"Deuced odd," said the Colonel.
"There's something deuced odd about the whole thing."
Miss Marple suddenly took her breath away by remarking in a placid voice, "Has Mrs. Prothero been saying that she committed the crime now?"
"Upon my soul," said the Colonel. "How did you come to guess that, Miss Marple?"
"Well, I rather thought it might happen," said Miss Marple. "I think dear Lettice thought so too. She's really a very sharp girl. Not always very scrupulous, I'm afraid. So Anne Prothero says she killed her husband. Well, well, I don't think it's true. No, I'm almost sure it isn't true. Not with a woman like Anne Prothero. Although one never can be quite sure about anyone, can one? At least that's what I've found. When does she say she shot him?"
"At 6:20, just after speaking to you."
Miss Marple shook her head slowly and pityingly. The pity was, I think, for two full-grown men being so foolish as to believe such a story. At least that is what we felt like.
"What did she shoot him with?"
"A pistol."
"Where did she find it?"
"She brought it with her."
"Well, that she didn't do," said Miss Marple with unexpected decision. "I can swear to that. She'd no such thing with her."
"You mightn't have seen it."
"Of course I should have seen it."
"If it had been in her handbag."
"She wasn't carrying a handbag."
"Well, it might have been concealed or upon her person."
Miss Marple directed a glance of sorrow and scorn upon him.
"My dear Colonel Melchett, you know what young women are nowadays, not ashamed to show exactly how the Creator made them. She hadn't so much as a handkerchief in the top of her stocking."
Melchett was obstinate.
"You must admit that it all fits in," he said. "The time, the overturned clock pointing to 6:22.
Miss Marple turned on me.
"Do you mean you haven't told him about that clock yet?"
"What about the clock, Clement?"
I told him. He showed a good deal of annoyance.
"Why on earth didn't you tell Slack this last night?"
"Because," I said, "he wouldn't let me."
"Nonsense. You ought to have insisted."
"Probably," I said, "Inspector Slack behaves quite differently to you than he does to me. I had no earthly chance of insisting."
"It's an extraordinary business altogether," said Melchett.
"If a third person comes along and claims to have done this murder, I shall go into a lunatic asylum."
"If I might be allowed to suggest," murmured Miss Marple.
"Well?"
"If you were to tell Mr. Redding what Mrs. Prothero has done, and then explain that you don't really believe it is her, and then if you were to go to Mrs. Prothero and tell her that Mr. Redding is all right, why then, they might, each of them, tell you the truth. And the truth is helpful, though I dare say they don't know very much themselves, poor things."
"It's all very well, but they are the only two people who had a motive for making away with Prothero."
"Oh, I wouldn't say that, Colonel Melchett," said Miss Marple.
"Why? Can you think of anyone else?"
"Oh, yes, indeed. Why?"
She counted on her fingers.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes, and a possible 7. I can think of at least 7 people who might be very glad to have Colonel Prothero out of the way."
The Colonel looked at her feebly.
7 people? In St. Mary Mead?"
Miss Marple nodded brightly.
"Mind you, I name no names," she said. "That wouldn't be right. But I'm afraid there's a lot of wickedness in the world. A nice, honourable, upright soldier like you doesn't know about these things, Colonel Melchett.
I thought the chief constable was going to have apoplexy.